Now back to it. We're talking about Adam in the Garden of Eden. And he had this challenge and he failed. And the result of the failure was, as I told you, the whole creation went down a giant step. Now, that affected his project in the following way. What was the project? Time for a recap. Adam is composed of soul and body. They are in conflict with one another. He, whoever he is, if he gives the victory to the soul then spiritualizes the body. As we spoke about the shell becoming transparent instead of becoming obliterated, the soul spiritualizes the body. Now, that was the project under the condition that he was created. In other words, he was in a 50-50 position, as we said, and his soul was of a certain type, and his body was of a certain type, not what we have today, because, I'll remind you, as I said 90 seconds ago, since the sin, everything was lowered. No, then it was on the original level. His so-called body was on a par with what we think of as our spirituality, and his spirituality was in the clouds, beyond us altogether. Now, in that condition, with that soul and that body, had he chosen correctly, then that soul would have been able to spiritualize that body. That's what would have happened. Okay, but he didn't. He failed. So the whole creation took a step down. Now we're struggling, soul and body, but the whole of our physical world came into existence anew at that time. As he was created, this physical didn't exist. And the soul lost a great deal of its power. Under present conditions, no matter how much we succeed, it will not be possible for us to completely spiritualize the body. Because of that reduction, because of that lowering, because the body element is much stronger now, and because the soul element has its powers greatly reduced, no matter how successful we will be in our struggle under these conditions, we will not be able to spiritualize the body entirely. That is why we have to die. That's why death is the consequence. Because death leads to the dissolution of the body. The body dissolves. There's a reconnection at resurrection. And when it's resurrected, it isn't the same body. It's made out of the same materials in some sense. And it represents the same element. It plays in some sense the same role. But it's on a par with the body that Adam got originally. Then the conditions are set for that final step to take place. I don't think we should do it. We talked about that a couple of days ago. But the final stage to take place where the body can become totally spiritualized. Here it is in a little more detail. If the soul is going to relate to the new body, the post-Eden body, the soul has to be greatly reduced in its strength. If you would have Adam's original strength soul, and you would have this newly lowered, physicalized, materialized body, you put them together, or it has an explosion. The body would be obliterated. The body can't handle a soul like that. So what happens is, transformers are put on the soul, and the voltage is stepped down. And it becomes much weaker. Only a tiny portion of its power is allowed to operate, so that it can operate together with the body in a cooperative manner. Now, with a greatly reduced power of soul, and a greatly strengthened and materialized body, we don't have the ability to spiritualize it completely. We can make some progress, but we can't spiritualize it completely. So here's what happens. In our world, the soul and the body struggle, and the extent to which the soul succeeds, in our world, remember, in our world it's like 70-30, not 50-50 anymore. The soul gains strength, which it can't use. It gains strength, but it can't use it. Because if it'll use it, it'll just blow the body away. It gains strength because it is increasing its spirituality. Definitely gains strength, but that strength is put in a bank. That strength is put in the bank. It can't use it for the body, and it can't totally integrate that strength because it's held back, it's reduced, it's, you know, part of it's asleep in a sense. It's not fully functioning. Then, when death occurs, the body disintegrates, the soul goes into a holding pattern, the world of souls as it's called, which is not, the words are ambiguous and different writers use them in different ways, but it's not the ultimate Olam HaBo. It's an interim stage, the world of souls. While in the world of souls, the soul can integrate into itself the strength that it acquired winning battles in our stage of existence. It can integrate it into itself. It can develop in itself to enhance, to complete the soul's power on itself. That's because it's alone. Since it's alone, it's not held back by the body. It's not, doesn't require it to be reduced so that it can relate to the body. It's not relating to the body. The body is rotting in the ground, and it's in the soul world. Then, in resurrection, you have a double change. On the one hand, the soul has integrated into itself all the strength it acquired from its successes here. The body, on the other hand, is a newly transformed body into the level, the status of Adam's body. Now you can have a marriage between the soul and the body. The soul not held back now, not restricted, not withheld, full strength. And with the soul comes full strength. Full strength meaning the strength that God gave it, and full strength meaning that which it incorporated through its battles in this lower stage of existence. That full strength soul, when it encounters the body, spiritualizes the body. And then the final project is finished. So that's the name of the game. In the terms of the image that I gave you of trying to get from A to B on the highway and then getting lost and beating around in the forest. So beating around in the forest is kind of doubly handicapped. On the one hand, the image is pretty good here. On the one hand, there's less light because the branches and the leaves reduce the light. That's like reducing the power of the soul. On the other hand, it's not a smooth highway. There are twigs and brambles and vines, underbrush, and, you know, and chipmunks, they'll nip at your toes, and all sorts of nasty little things there in the forest. So there's less light to see by, and there's more resistance on the ground, so the going is much tougher. But if you think of the experience of making progress under those conditions, the experience of making progress under those conditions can give strength to the soul, maybe even strength comparable to marching from A to B on an open highway. Even if in the forest you cover 2 miles, and the march from A to B is 50 miles, but the march from A to B is on an open highway in the sunshine. And the 2 miles in the forest are struggling through the underbrush with very little light. If you ask which way is the soul strengthened by the experience, could be that the strengthening of the soul amounts to the same thing. So if the goal is to strengthen the soul, you could begin to see how there could be a parity between the two of them. Only the results can't take place because as you're tramping through the forest and your muscles getting stronger and stronger, you're still not getting to be. You're just still tramping around in the forest. There's something else that has to happen. You can imagine, after training in the forest so long, you finally get back to the highway, going from A to B is a cinch. You know, you're a Superman now. You have to bang you around in the forest. You're so strong, it's a race to be without any trouble. Something like that. That's roughly the picture that he gives us here. And that's to understand what we are accomplishing this stage of history. Yeah.
If I understand that correctly, then we're not really adding to our, then we are adding to our soul, but it's more like in the bank in this right now. It's not like we can add to our soul in the here and now.
Okay, so maybe I should qualify it a little bit. You're right. I mean, I'm trying to get a short description of a complicated picture, but you're right. Some strengthening can happen here, just like some purification of the body can happen here, but it can't do the ultimate job. And a lot of the strength that you acquire here is put in the bank, because if you would use it here, it would just blow the body away. Yeah.
Aren't there some people that can go beyond that point in this world? I personally think there are. I mean, there's a small few, and I think there's a small permanent generation.
Okay. I think this is a difference of opinion. It's a difference of opinion. Ramchal says someplace else, not here, that there are no exceptions. He said even Elijah, who went bodily to heaven, before the end, will have to die. Everyone has to die. That's an element, and even for a half hour.
I'm saying that they have to die. I'm saying, but I think spiritually, their soul can be greater than someone that a regular person. You know what I'm saying?
I didn't say anything about that. I didn't say anything about that. In fact, I just admitted to him that some of the strength that you get by winning battles here, you can have even here. So yeah, I didn't say that there couldn't be. What did I say that spares on what you're saying?
No. You said that we're only 30% soul, and I forget what the percentage was, and the rest of us is...
No, I didn't say that. I was referring to what I said the other day. I say the battle, Adam's battle, was a 50-50 battle. The strength of his soul and the strength of his body were equal, so that his choice would be a completely free choice. For us, that's not true. For us, it's much harder. For us, in terms of the strength of choice, we're 70% body and 30% soul. Not how we're composed, but where our motivations are. A tzaddik, these great people that you're referring to, are so because even in a 70-30 deficit, look how well they did. Right? But they start off at the same deficit because they're born like everybody else. They're babies like everybody else. They have to work, many of them anyway, have to work for a living like everybody else. So the deficits are built into life. There's something which you can't avoid. They're tzaddik because they did even greater than the rest of us. Yeah.
You talk about the body that we reach a point where we can't become any more soul-like. Spiritual. So do we all have the power to be like Elijah all the same? So only once we reach that level do we reach a point where actually it goes, as you say, like
Your logic is good. I have no... I want to say something else there. Your logic is good. In fact, there was another one like that in a way. Is Chanoch, because it doesn't say he died, so God took him. And there are sources that say the same thing happened to Chanoch. But understand that that's only temporary. According to Ramchal, they too will have to die. Just, it's temporary, it's delayed for a long time.
Do we need to reach that level before, as you say, we get to the mark?
No. You don't have to reach that level in order to qualify for stage two where you go all the way. But listen, I want to pick up on something you said. And I, even though this might hurt, I'm doing you a favor. You say, in my opinion, there are people like that. Now, really, opinions aren't free. Opinions have to be backed up. A person should have a reason for an opinion. If he doesn't have a reason, then he ought to not have an opinion. You know, in America they say everyone has the right to an opinion. That's wrong. It isn't so that everyone has the right to an opinion. For it to be appropriate to have an opinion, you have to pay the price of having a reason for it. Otherwise, you should be honest and accurate and say, I haven't got any information, so I don't know. Now, how would you know? What evidence would you have that there are people that go beyond a certain stage? If you have sources, fine. But to have an opinion, it seems to me there are, is something which, and in America you would treat, well, that's my opinion. Say, well, so what if it's your opinion? Now, here's my example. Someone comes up to you in the street and says, you are a Nazi. What? I'm a Nazi. Well, he says, well, that's my opinion. I said, well, but what, you think you have letters of mine or emails of mine or pretending my dreams or something? No, that's just my opinion. Oh, no. You can't have an opinion like that. You have no right to an opinion like that. You take a stand, you have an obligation to be able to back it up somehow. You earn an opinion by mastering the subject. When I taught university, from time to time, I used to teach my undergraduates about the debates between Einstein and Bohr about quantum mechanics. I'd lay out the two positions, and then often they would ask, so who's right? Who are you asking? Me? Give me a break. Who am I? I feel my life is a little richer because I can understand this enormous debate. Am I going to have an opinion? Who's right? I can tell you what other people think. I'll tell you what John Wheeler thinks is right, what Richard Feynman thinks is right. They have Nobel Prizes in physics. You're asking me who's right? I can't have an opinion of my own. I don't deserve an opinion of my own because I don't know the subject that well. So this idea that everybody has a right to an opinion has to be put in the box all around. Yeah. That's my opinion. Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
Yesterday we said that Adam was created in a way that he was not able to transgress anything deliberately.
Right.
My question is, what's the difference then between him and us? Can we transgress anything deliberately?
Of course. Of course, that's a very important point. I've never put it in here, but that's a symptom of how degraded the world has come, that has become. I know you want to go on, but just let me give you a moment to broaden this. I can use material that we've talked about already. How is it that we are able to transgress knowingly, deliberately, on purpose, and he wasn't? I spoke about this. When did I speak about suffering? That was before I left, huh? Way back in hell. I'm not going to go through the whole thing again. But the criterion here, the symptom here is this. How hidden is God? How hidden is God? In order to transgress deliberately, knowingly, one has to be able, there has to be part of you that feels that this transgression is good. Good for this. Has this benefit, although it is forbidden, but what's forbidden is to get this benefit. You have to be able to see some sort of benefit in the forbidden thing. Then you could say, okay, I know it's forbidden, but I'm doing it for that benefit. That's a measure of great hiddenness. Because, in truth, there can't be any benefit at all in a transgression. There can't be. After all, God is good. He is the source of all good. And he's the source of everything. So what he gives is good. And anything that goes against what he gives cannot be good. It can't be good. So for me to take seriously the idea that this cheeseburger, okay, God said no, but boy, does it taste good. And boy, you know, they say that meat and milk compete with protein. You know, that's what the dietitians will tell you. So you know, nutritionally, you get a benefit, amino acids, all that kind of song and dance. So, I said, you know, okay, so what God is telling me is, there is a benefit here, but I shouldn't have it. No, how could there be a benefit there if God said not to have it? Where's the benefit coming from? Somebody else? You mean the all-good God is telling me you got to give up this benefit? How could the all-good creator do that? So, in truth, there can't be a benefit there. For me to see it as a benefit, or for part of me to see it as a benefit, that requires a great degree of divine hiddenness. That I can't see that God's goodness is in the source of everything. Now, the truth is, I'm making this up as I go along. I mean, I'm having new ideas now. Even at my age, it does happen. That's how I know I'm alive. So in Adam's condition, in Adam's original condition, God was revealed enough so that he couldn't be taken in by that. What? God said no, and there's a benefit in it? No, that can't be. Only if I can figure out how God said yes to this, then there could be a benefit. But if I know he said no, there can't be a benefit. In our world, God is so hidden that we can be deceived or deceive ourselves into thinking that there really is a benefit there, just if God said no. You see, emotionally, how does it feel? He's depriving me. Okay, he has a right to deprive me. He's the creator. And he's much stronger than I am. He's promising me all of my ball. Yeah, I got all the reasons. But in the bottom of it, he's depriving me. He's telling me, give it up. So that's a struggle with a lie. That's a struggle with a lie. But we are subject to that lie. Part of us is taken in by that illusion because God is so greatly concealed. In Adam's world, God wasn't so greatly concealed. So that lie, which is the gross Yetzirah, here, cheeseburger, go for it, that he couldn't be taken in by that. Only if he could be convinced or convince himself that God wants it. And then the failure is in the convincing. Yes?
As I see it, it is a matter of only a matter of knowledge. In his times, in the Adam's times, it was clear for him the existence of God. That's why he was not able to do anything deliberately. In our times, it's hidden from us some knowledge we don't know so clear, that's why we do it. But still, if we would have this clarity, we wouldn't do anything deliberately.
Okay, this is a very, very important point. I'll give it medium treatment. Some of you who are in my Chumash here have heard me speak about it. But it's an extremely important point. Is it correct? Is it right to say, if I know something clearly, clearly, without doubt, that that will dictate my actions, that I will act in terms of what I know clearly? Is that a right proposition? I don't know if anybody here studied philosophy, but it was an old, old disagreement between Plato and Aristotle. Now, the Jewish tradition says that Aristotle was right and Plato was wrong. You can know clearly what is right. You can know what the reasons are. Have no doubt about it. And still do wrong. Leave alone morality. Leave alone spirituality. Let's talk about what's good or bad for you here and now. People can have no doubt whatsoever that doing A is bad for me here and now. Bad physically. Physically, it's going to cost me money, pain, embarrassment, my job, whatever it is, and do it anyway. There are lots of examples. People don't go to the dentist. People eat the wrong things, drink the wrong things, inject the wrong things. Students, nobody here, of course, but students do wait till the night before the exam to study for the exam, even though they know from experience that it's not good, they do it anyway. And they don't get up in time for appointments in the morning because they're lazy and they know what it costs them to do it anyway. Shy people do not move themselves to make a social contact, even though they know from past experience that when the other person does it, they have a good time. They know they can carry on a conversation. They know they're reasonably pleasant people. But they can't initiate, even though it's very painful to stand there and not talk to anybody at a social gathering. They can't do it anyway. So people do things in the light of against the light of clear, unquestioned knowledge all the time. So knowing something is not the clue. The clue is experiencing. And experience can be so powerful that while you're having the experience, your actions are dictated. But the minute the experience is over, the person retains free will because all he's got left is knowledge. One clear example of this is the prophet Jonah. God tells Jonah, in prophecy, go to Nineveh. And Jonah takes a ticket for Tarshish. No, I'm not doing that. Now, had the prophecy continued, he'd have been a robot. There'd be no way he could rebel. But the prophecy ended. All he has is the knowledge. Yes, that's what God told me. But I have my reasons. I have reasons to do differently. And the reasons that he has, even though rationally he could tell himself, I know God told me to do it. He's the creator. He's running the world. He can't be right. And he does it anyway. So it's not true that knowledge is the issue. What the issue is experience. That's why I said that God was revealed. Revealed in the sense of visible, palpable, observable in the environment. And that's what Adam couldn't go against. Whereas we, although we know it because we're taught it, we know it because we have certain proofs of it, that's not enough to stop us from doing what's wrong, as it is not enough to stop us from doing things that are self-destructive throughout life. Yes?
Just the last thing you're saying was the whole thing with Bennett, with God would only give, God would tell, everything God lets us do is something that we benefit from, and things he doesn't let us do is something that we shouldn't do, and that's...
I've changed my vocabulary.
Okay,
and I'm gonna put in here another footnote because you inadvertently raised another issue which is worth mentioning. How did he change my vocabulary? He changed it to vocabulary permission. He said anything that God lets you do will be good, and anything permits you from it. I didn't say let. I didn't say permit.
What God tells us to do is good,
right.
And what God tells us not to do is not good.
Right. Now, what's the difference? It's an opportunity for me to insert a commercial, so I'm going to do that. There are people whose attitude towards Jewish observance, Jewish values, Torah, is the following. I want to do X. Show me where it's forbidden. And I won't do it. I'm just as firm as you are. I believe in the Shulchan Aruch and the code of Jewish law. I want to do X. Show me where it's forbidden. If you can show me where it's forbidden, I won't do it. But if you can't show me where it's forbidden, so then there's no reason not to do it. If I want to do it, I can surely do it. Now, Rav Shach, inside of the Bracha, said many years ago, it was a Chazon Ish. He said many years ago that there are people for whom there are 613 problems. There are 613 problems. I want to do X. Is any of the mitzvahs standing in my way? Are there any mitzvah obstacles here? If there are, I won't do it. I believe in the obstacles. So So for him, life is running an obstacle course. Let's see if I can avoid all the mitzvahs. If I can just steer around in between the mitzvahs and miss all of them, then I'm home free and I can do what I want. And when I put it that way, which is really at base of the philosophical description of the idea, you can already hear what's wrong with it. A mitzvah is and is the only opportunity to connect with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. It's the only way to be connected. So they're starting with the wrong question. The question is not, show me it's forbidden. If it's forbidden, I won't do it. But if it's not forbidden, it's free for me to choose. The question really should be, show me where you are fulfilling some mitzvah. Show me which mitzvah you're fulfilling. The goal of life is not to steer in between the mitzvahs and miss all of them. The goal of life is to be connected to mitzvahs all the time. And if you can't show me where you're fulfilling some mitzvah, then of course it's wrong. It's not wrong because God said it's wrong. It's because if you appreciate what mitzvahs are, what life is, you're wasting it. So that's why the language of permissible is really, I would never use that language unless I slipped, which could happen. But I said what God tells you to do and what God forbids you to do. Not things that are neutral in the middle. In addition to which, the Chovos Levavos says there is no neutral. But that's a technical point. I'm not using that. I'm taking the general philosophical orientation. The mitzvos are our only opportunity to connect with God. And since the whole purpose of life is connecting with God, the burden of proof is on the one who wants to do X to show us where doing X fulfills some mitzvah. The burden is not on the opponent, the critic, to show where it's violating something and that way stop it. Now, I would change the vocabulary and sort of a commercial, which did only take 3 minutes. I guess that's permissible. I'll be happy to take your questions. Let's put it in context. He said, and quite rightly, that we are now in a condition where we can do it deliberately. Adam couldn't do that. So I was analyzing, what's the difference between Adam and us? For us to be able to do it deliberately, there has to be at least part of me that says, there's something good over here. I'm choosing it, knowing it's wrong. Right? And then when you resist, you say, well, even though there's something good over here, I'm not going to do it. But all of this struggle, this whole struggle is based on a lie. It's based on the lie that there is something good over there.
When you do it, you're not choosing it knowing it's wrong. You're convincing yourself that it's good. You're choosing it, thinking it's good.
No, I didn't say that. And that would fall into the trap that he started with. I'm not saying you're convincing yourself, although I must say, Ophthesis is something close, but it's not quite the same idea. I'm not saying you're convincing yourself. That's closer to Plato, it's doing it, knowing that it's wrong, on the grounds that there's also a benefit here. Also, I'm not taking away the fact that it's wrong. I'm of a split mind. See, how does free will work? Free will works because you're split. Okay, now when you split, you can choose one over the other. That doesn't mean the other isn't there. Just as when I do a mitzvah, and I still feel the temptation to do the avera, and I'm pushing it down, and I feel a certain frustration that I didn't satisfy that desire, my choosing the mitzvah doesn't mean that the yetzer hara, the evil inclination, goes away. It doesn't go away, I just say no, and I push him behind, and I go on doing the right thing. Same thing the other way. If the person, God forbid, does an avera, doesn't mean the good inclination goes away. Doesn't mean his intellectual clarity goes away. He knows it and does it anyway. That's the real, ultimate freedom of the will. The freedom to choose which way to go in the light of all the ways that are in front of you. And to keep it there. They should remain there. Rodessa talks about focusing. If you'll ever read Rodessa's essay on free will, he says something like this. As long as you're focused on the truth, you can't do wrong. Let's see if anybody can play the game here. Okay. He says, as long as you're focused on the truth, you can't do wrong. So where's your free will? To choose your focus. Quite right. You can choose your focus. If you choose to focus on the truth, but then the whole battle is choosing your focus. Right? And then when you focus on the illusion, it doesn't mean the truth goes away, you're just not focusing on it. Right? It's there, just not using it. And when you chose to focus, they had to be both in front of you. The truth and the illusion are both in front of you, and I'm choosing which one to focus on. So it's not a question of ridding yourself of the illusion. That's not what's going on. What's going on is focusing or acting on one over the other. Okay? pretty good stuff. We're doing a lot of good talking there. Yeah.
I said at the beginning that if in the lower world we have the same soul as Adam, then the soul would blow away the body.
Right.
What does that mean?
I don't know what it means. I just told you words. That's good enough, isn't it? I could probably only give you an analogy. Try running a flight simulator on a 486. You don't even remember 486s, huh? That was before you were born.
Yeah,
you know, on a very slow computer.
It's about two after the XP, right?
Yeah, that's what you used to carry them around in trucks. You know? If you have a very sophisticated program running on a very slow computer, you know, let's say with 60 megabytes of RAM, right? It's just not going to run, or it's going to take a half hour to go from screen to screen. It's just going to be overloaded, overpowered. It's not going to be able to function. Here, it's even worse. Here, it's just going to obliterate it. It's going to run. It's sort of like plugging your clock radio into a socket that's supposed to run a power motor. So, you know, it's just the surge of electricity is going to blow it up.
I think I understand the analogy, but then
okay.
But then if you have for example, we said that Adam's soul and his body were 50-50 in the fight. And we, in our fights, our soul is at 30 and our body is at 70. If we had a higher soul, then our soul and our body would be 50-50, even though our soul is more physical. Because you're saying our soul gets dropped all the way from Adam down to us, but then it gets dropped so far that it's 30-70. I mean, you're right. Maybe if we had Adam's soul, it would be 70 soul and 30 body. Lower it a little bit of Adam, we don't have to go all the way down to where we're lower than the body.
So you're asking, why can't we lower the soul proportionately to the strength of the body in such a way as to retain a 50-50 balance?
How long is the soul? How long is the soul? It's already 70-30 against the...
Yeah, he means lower it less. He means lower it less. That's what he means. But then the analogy that I'm giving has already explained that. Because if you were to step up the soul to the point where its strength would be equal to that of the body. Strength, maybe this is a problem. I'm using the word strength in two different ways, in two different contexts, and they're getting crossed, and that'll be my fault. When I say 70-30 or 50-50, I'm talking about the motivation. I'm talking about the motivation. The person is equally pulled in both directions. I'm not talking about the strength of the thing. I don't know if you can compare the strength of the soul and the strength of the body. They're two entirely different kinds of things, you know. Sort of like talking about the strength of Shakespeare versus the strength of steel. I mean, Shakespeare is strong drama and steel is strong building materials. Well, can one be stronger than the other? It's just two different worlds. When I say 70-30 or 50-50, I'm talking about the psychological pull in the person. He's pulled equally in both directions. And you know very well, some of your decisions are harder, and some of your decisions are easier. Some of them are trivial, and some of them are extremely difficult, and some of them are medium hard. Something like that. I'm talking psychology now. I'm not talking about the items themselves as entities in God's world, how He created them. It'd be hard to talk about the soul in that way at all. Then, I talk about the soul only in comparative terms. Stronger and weaker under these conditions and those conditions. I don't talk about how it compares to the body. I never talk about that. So all we say is that the body has become so physicalized that a soul, the original strength, would blow it away. So the soul has had less strength than it had before. That's inherent strength. That has nothing to do with psychology. But now, as a result of the fact that the body is much stronger and the soul is much reduced, as a result of those two changes, when I bring it now to psychology, of course the psychology is very much out of balance. To make the psychology in balance would require giving the soul in and of itself much more strength, but by giving much more strength, then it's incompatible with the body. What is that?
I just wanted to know, like,
explain the why it's easier to do some transgressions with some people than others?
So Maimonides says that people are born with a different quality of soul. I mean, I'm putting it a little, with a little different quality of soul and a different quality of body, so that each person's character, personality, desires, strengths, and weaknesses will be different. So that each person's job is different. I have known people for whom laziness was in every cell of their body. You know, the alarm clock goes up in the morning. The only goal is to snooze alarm. Where's that button? Give me another half hour. And there are other people who, either through their DNA or through their early childhood experiences, who getting up in the morning is a snap. On 2 hours sleep, it's a snap. My father, Oliver Sholem, trained me. I had no trouble getting up in the morning, no matter how little sleep I got. And I had a roommate once who it was murder to get up. And I, you know, a nice guy. I liked him. But it was murder to get him up out of bed in the morning. So people are born with different strengths and different weaknesses, and they're put in that way so that each person has a different test. Each person has a different job. So, yeah.
The thing we were talking about earlier about the kind of bank that your soul gets spiritual mitzvah that you do here. So are you saying that when we reach ideally a certain point, the mitzvah that we do, there's no longer any, we don't get any spirit, any noticeable spiritual gain from it here?
That could be, but it's not necessarily true. There could be different dimensions of spiritual gain, or if you like the mathematics, you could approach it as an asymptote, and you could be far enough from the top that there's still noticeable changes. I mean, you can work it out in a variety of ways. It doesn't have to, but it could be true. It could very well be true. Indeed, Ramchal says that the soul has many layers, the vast majority of which we are totally unconscious. We have no consciousness of them at all. And he says something which is disturbing to some people, including me, but this is what he says. I have a proof of it, he says. The Talmud tells us, and I think all of you know it, that on Shabbos you get an extra soul. Right? You're totally unconscious of that. We're totally unconscious. Everybody's totally unconscious of it. It's something that nobody's conscious of. Now, we all think, but you know, they're great tzaddikim and they must feel it and so on and so on. There's a statement in the Talmud. If a person gets lost in the wilderness, loses track of time, what should he do about keeping Shabbos? So the Talmud says like this: for the major biblical transgressions, he should try to avoid them every day. But that's only negative. What about celebrating Shabbos? So that he won't forget what it's like to celebrate Shabbos, he should pick one day a week and celebrate. Which day should that be? So the Talmud has two views. One is, wherever he is, let him count 6 days and then celebrate the seventh day. That's the way it was done, right? That's what the Ten Commandments say. 6 days you shall work, and the seventh day shall be Shabbos. The other opinion says, no, let him take the very next day and celebrate that as Shabbos and then keep track and do it every 7 days. Where would that come from? Quiz time for 10 points. Where would the idea come from to take the very next day and make it Shabbos? Well, boys and girls. Was there ever in the history of mankind such a thing where the very next day was Shabbos?
Sure,
when Adam was created. Adam was created on Friday. So his very next day was Shabbos. So the two different opinions in the Talmud reflect either Adam's Shabbos or the biblical Shabbos coming later. One or the other. No one says, wait a minute, gentlemen. When Shabbos comes in, you'll have an extra soul. So you know, when you feel the extra soul, that Shabbos, you'll know for sure. No one says. So anyway, you have to appreciate that the vast majority of the soul is for us unconscious. That doesn't mean it isn't there, and that ask Freud to tell you about all the things that are unconscious that are still there. And it doesn't mean you're not interacting with them. You just don't feel it. You're not conscious of it. When Chazal tell us that on Shabbos you have an extra soul, what they're telling us is that what you do has a special significance. Because that extra soul is available, and what you do interacts with that extra level of soul, even though you're not conscious of it. Yeah.
So, I mean, from my understanding, is the main point that we're getting out of this soul bank the fact that the spiritual
good that we're doing for ourselves by the mitzvah is just too much to put in, to give us in this body?
Yeah, in other words, I would, you got the right point. I would say there's a lot more being accomplished than you can feel. That's what there's a lot more being accomplished than you can feel, because that part, that extra part, can't be used in this world. But it's there, and it will definitely benefit you. Yeah?
How do you train so you get up at the sun?
When I was about 14, and we were members of a Reform synagogue in Westchester County, White Plains, New York. And our shift at the Sunday school began at 11:30. So they came to pick us up at 11 o'clock in the morning. Very considerate Sunday morning, huh? And my father, Oliver Sholem, used to bang on the door at 7:30 and say, get up. I said, Dad, they're coming in 3.5 hours. You know, why do I have to get up? And he used to say, don't sleep your life away. Get up. Well, I can tell you, I did not like it. But he gave me a gift, which I have benefited from my whole life. They gave me a number of such gifts, but this was one. From that time, if I set an alarm, I'm up like that. It's not a struggle at all. It's just, he gave it to me. I don't get any credit for it. He instilled it in me, and it became part of my behavioral repertoire, and I just do it. So it can definitely be trained in a person. I would say it's the same for everybody, but it definitely happened to me that way. But before he started that regimen, I did not want to. I could have slept till 11 easily. That wouldn't have been any problem. You know, after all, after Saturday night. Yes, you had a question.
I'm trying to understand this concept of sanctification of Hashem's name. Yesterday we said that Adam did it for this purpose. But as I understand it, it requires the public.
It's good that you picked up on that. If you look in the Rambam, in Hilchos Yisrael HaTorah, Perek Hei, the fifth chapter of the laws of the fundamentals of Torah, that chapter is, the whole chapter is about Kiddush Hashem, about sanctification of God's name. And he says explicitly, any mitzvah that is done for God's sake is a sanctification of his name. There are two types. There's sanctification of his name in public, that's one type. And then there's sanctification of his name without the public. Sanctification of his name is not defined by being in public. And in fact, in Hebrew, when they want to talk about it, they always say, Kiddush Hashem Birabim. The Eran Birabim. Because that's not the only kind. Otherwise, they could leave it off and just say Kiddush Hashem. People do have this impression that Kiddush Hashem means creating a good reputation for God and in the eyes of people who are watching you. But it's not limited to that. Yeah?
It is. I didn't understand what you were trying to bring out there. You said that soul has like many layers.
Because he asked, he said that according to what I have been saying, that when you do a mitzvah and that gives increased strength, and he asked, but most of it, as I said, you don't feel, it's put up in that bank. So I mean, indicating that there's parts of the soul also which could be affected by it, which don't interact with what you're doing, because at least not directly, because you're not conscious of it. I'm just adding to the idea that there are hidden places where these mitzvahs can have an effect that you won't be conscious of at all. Right. The general message is the accomplishment is not measured by what you see. That's the general message. Now, one last idea, and then we stop to try and prepare for this. I mentioned to you a couple of times that not only is there resurrection for the body and the soul together, the person gets reunited in terms of his two parts, and then he goes into Olam Haba, the afterlife, whole body and soul, with transformation, but both elements are there. But the world also is perfected. The world also is perfected. And the world also goes into all of above. The world element, the world dimension, although transformed. Now, putting that together with what I said at the beginning of the hour, what has to happen to us in order for the soul to ultimately spiritualize the body? We have to undergo what has to happen to us?
Body has to die.
Die. You have to die, right? This body can't be spiritualized the way it is. So there's death, the body disintegrates, it's remade in the fashion similar to Adam, and then it can be spiritualized. So if that's true, and the world also, as a whole, is going to follow us, shouldn't there also be a kind of death and disintegration for the world as a whole? It's made of the same stuff that the body is made of. And the answer is yes. And the answer is that Chazal actually say this. They say 6,000 years of this history, 7,000 years of the times of Mashiach. The 8,000 years there is destruction. And then Chazal said this is the death of the world. And after that, the world idea, the world dimension is reconstituted, just like the body is reconstituted. And that's how the world as a whole can go on into eternity. It too has to die, it has to be disintegrated, and has to be formed, reconstituted. So there's exact parallelism between what happens to the person in that respect and what happens to the world as a whole.